The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now I'm joined in studio by Pete the Vet. Pete, you were shuffling away there. Is your seat satisfactory to you now?
Yes, it's all comfy now. The wires are getting tangled up around the wheels.
Well, as usual, we have loads of questions for you, so we'll try to get to them because as we're a nation of animal lovers, aren't we, here in Ireland?
Much more so now than in the past, I have to say. It's been a cultural shift, really, whereas people now genuinely see their pets as members of the family and they look after them like that as well.
Yeah, we've taken the dogs in from outside the kennels and they're in. They're in the beds, but that's another discussion for another day. Ailish in Dublin says, my four-year-old Cocker Spaniel panting a lot lately for the past few months when at rest. Not normal for him. Could there be something underlying here?
The first thing I'd wonder about is anxiety. Like, the signs of anxiety in dogs are sometimes quite subtle and panting is one of them. So I'd be looking for other signs of anxiety, such as if he's licking his lips a lot, or if he's starting to lick his front feet, or if he's behaving in other different ways. There are medical reasons for panting as well, but generally if there's a medical reason, there'll be other signs of illness, you know, such as digestive disorder or maybe coughing or not being able to exercise properly. So as long as he's carrying on his normal daily functions physically, then I wouldn't worry too much about a medical cause if there's no other signs. And I'd be wondering, looking at his lifestyle and see, is there anything that could be bothering him a bit? Like social changes, like fireworks noises outside, and we're already seeing that. Traffic noises outside even, like big vehicles driving past. Lots of subtle things can make dogs feel just a bit agitated, and then panting is sometimes the consequence.
Okay, so I mean, you'd sort of think panting could be related to the heart. You don't think go to the vet, get the heart checked or anything.
Well, I mean, if it's extreme, obviously that's what you do. But if it's just that she's noticed him panting more often than he used to, then I wouldn't jump to that. A dog with heart disease will generally have other signs of other physical signs as well as just a bit of extra panting.
Okay, good stuff. I'm getting my five-year-old Schnauzer neutered on Monday. I'm very worried. He's in general good health. How will this impact his behaviour and well-being?
Probably less than you'd expect, actually. There used to be this kind of myth that if a dog was castrated, they'd become like a big soft jelly baby, you know, and they would be much more just lying around, sedentary, passive. That's not the case at all. I've always had all my male dogs castrated and they've just carry on being as they are. So I'd expect that the male hormone driven behaviours would tend to go away. So if he's a dog who tends to mount people or objects, if he tends to cock his leg when he comes into a room and walks around it to mark his territory, if he tends to muscle up to other dogs without some walks and sometimes get into a bit of aggro. These are male hormone-driven behaviours that will tend to go away a bit more so. It is complex, though, and our veterinary thoughts on castration has changed in recent years. For example, we know now that male hormones are helpful to dogs to give them some confidence in social interactions. So if you've got a shivery, shaky dog that's very anxious around other animals altogether and around people, you'd be more likely to say perhaps we shouldn't castrate this dog. Perhaps he needs his male hormones to give him a little bit of a confidence lift. So vets are having far more, I suppose, discussions now about castration as a procedure. Whereas in the past, we would tend to say, you know, whop them off every dog when they get 6 months of age. We're not saying that so much anymore.
Because I suppose you don't want a load of strays running around, and that is a big concern, isn't
yes.
it?
Well, it's population control is important, most often it's females that are the biggest issue because they're actually producing the puppies. Male dogs aren't going to contribute to new puppies if they're restrained and kept in all the time and under the owner's control. So it's not such a big issue.
Okay, because you do often wonder, are you messing with nature? Not that they all have to become parents necessarily, but that you're messing with their hormone levels, that, you know, if you're going to neuter a female or a male, that it's going to mess with the order of things.
Well, it doesn't cause as big an impact as you think, but, you know, it is kind, you're right, it's almost like a philosophical point. And in some countries, some Scandinavian countries, it's actually highly unethical to castrate or spay animals routinely. They don't do that. They believe it's wrong. They believe it's impinging on the animal's rights to a normal life, if you like. And I've had people sometimes get upset with me for suggesting it because they say, why should I interfere with my pet's sex life? You know, this kind of stuff. Because, you know, they wouldn't like it done to themselves. I mean, that's pretty extreme, you know.
I meant more on a hormonal level. And you do feel bad as a dog owner to have, a puppy jumping around the place and then all of a sudden they've the cone on, they've had major surgery. But it's for the greater good and it doesn't impact them too much.
In most cases, it helps dogs settle in more and be more comfortable and more attuned to living with humans in our society. And that's why we do it. Dogs generally make easier companions when they're castrated, just in general. So it's easier for them and it's easier for us. As I say, it's very much more on an individual basis now rather than automatically getting every male dog done. And it's one for reflection and for discussion with your vet about your individual dog.
Interesting. Why does my Bichon Frise, says another, bite away at his feet as he's already been at the vet before with cream and antibiotics a while back?
Very, very common. It's generally because of an allergy of some kind or sensitivity. Often dogs just walking on different surfaces and their feet get a little bit of a layer of something on them, whether it's pollens or dusts or even chemicals, I don't know. Something which causes the feet to react, the skin between the toes to react and to become red and sore. And when that happens, the dog then licks it. And when they lick it, they make it worse by licking and biting. And then it's a vicious circle. So often you need medication to take away the redness and soreness. Then the dog will leave it alone. And once you've done that, as long as the thing which started it in the first place has gone away, then that'll be it fixed. Sometimes dogs need to have ongoing medication because whatever's causing it is out there and is still out there. And if you don't give ongoing medication, it just flares up again and again. It is one to discuss with your vet in detail, but I would say a simple thing people could do is wash their dog's feet whenever they come back from a walk. Just wash their feet in a basin of water, and that will remove some level of the things which might be causing an irritation.
Yeah, and obviously the things on the walk that you're not in control of, but should we look at what we're washing our floors and carpets with?
Well, that is another thing. I think it's interesting that these days we tend to use chemicals in our home that we don't rinse off. You know, you wash the floor with something, you put the liquidy stuff into the, dilute it in a bucket and you wash the floor and you don't rinse the floor afterwards, you just leave it on. And that's fine for us because we wear socks and shoes generally. But maybe if dogs are continually contacting it, some sensitive dogs may be affected by that. So that's one of the things people should look at, yes.
Okay, interesting. As we enter the winter, is there anything I should do to prepare my Labrador for cool weather?
I think really Labradors are very well able to cope with cold weather. And unless there's a problem, I don't think I would do anything in particular. You might feed your dog a little bit more in the winter because they need a bit more energy to keep their body warm. But, you know, most Labradors are carrying an extra layer of body fat anyway. They're not don't tend to be skinny animals. So I would really just carry on with life as normal.
Because we do often see the smaller dogs wearing coats, but we don't need them for the bigger ones.
I think for the average dog, you don't need to know. I think that if you have a small dog that got a bigger surface area to body weight size, that means they're more prone to getting chilled. Simply, their body loses more weight, more heat, more easily. So they do benefit from a little jacket. Bigger dogs, I don't generally see it as being an issue. No.
Okay. How often should I worm my dog? Says another. My vet says once a month, but I think he just wants to sell me more worming tablets to make money out of me. That's from Donna in Talla. Your practice isn't in Talla, is it?
No, we're in Bray. First of all, I say that's not something I don't think vets do. I think they basically are focused on making sure that there's minimal risk to pets. And there's a big misunderstanding about worms. I need to explain this as best I can. First of all, our attitude to worms these days, again, is individualized. Used to be, do this for every dog all the time, and that's it. These days, you say, okay, let's look at a dog's lifestyle. Let's see what the risk is to them. And the big risk, and the reason why dogs should often be wormed once a month, is something called lungworm. Now, dogs get lungworm from eating slugs and snails and frogs, okay? And what happens is the lungworm goes into their intestines, it's absorbed into their bloodstream, and it goes to the lungs and makes them cough. And that's not the big issue. The big issue is that it also, when the lungworm is in the body, it stops the blood from clotting. And what that means is the dog is prone to internal hemorrhages. And so what I know is that in our practice in Bray, in County Wicklow, we see around about one dog a year with longworm, suffering the consequences. And what that means is we see young adult dogs suddenly dying overnight, just like that. People wake up and their dog is dead and they go, what the heck happened? They have an autopsy done and they find the dog had a brain hemorrhage and has evidence of longworm. So this is, it's not common, but to me, a case once a year for a big enough vet practice to see one case a year, it makes you go, well, I want to do everything possible to make sure that never happens again. So what that means is the only way you can properly prevent longworm is by giving a particular worm dose, not any old worm dose, not just one you pick up in the supermarket, a specific worm dose that acts against longworm. And you have to give that once a month to be absolutely sure your dog doesn't get longworm. Now, that said, I don't say to my clients, to all of them, you must all worm your dogs once a month. What I'd say to people is, what is the risk? How does your dog spend its life? If you've got a little apartment miniature Dachshund that never goes on grass and never forages around the garden, never eats slugs or snails, the risk is minimal. If your dog is outside rummaging around, like a lot of Irish dogs, in the garden, and if there's a high risk that they are eating slugs and snails, then yes, you should give them that worm dose, that particular worm dose, once a month. So it's important to understand that. And if your dog isn't a slug or snail eater, you might say, well, okay, what about if I don't think they do it? What about if I just give a less often worm dose? Well, for example, if you gave your dog a worm dose every 3 months against longworm, then what you would do is you'd reduce the risk of longworm by 50%. Okay, so it's a significant difference, but it's not complete protection. But that might be enough for you. So it's very much a case of you know, considering what risk your dog's at and making a call on what risk you as an owner are prepared to take. And that's different between everybody, you see.
Okay, one final one to squeeze in. My cat hates getting into his carrier. Do you have any suggestions on how to encourage her to feel more comfortable around it?
Definitely. You should basically don't put the carrier on top of your wardrobe and pull it down every time you want to go to the vet, because your cat will just see it as this alien object that's going to cause it to have a frightening experience. So what you should do instead is get the carrier down and have it in the living room or in the corner of whatever room you're spending time and your cat's spending time, and take the lid off it, have it just sitting there, and then put the lid back on it and put some treats inside it, and basically make that cat carrier a part of your cat's daily life, so that they see it as somewhere that's quite normal, and even because you put treats in it, even somewhere they quite like. If you do that, then they'd be far happier to get into it when it is time to go to the vet.
Now, I have a bit of a tip in that area, and I don't know how the vet is going to feel about this, but my friend gave it to me. We call it the 45er. So you have to put it at a 45 degree angle, maybe on your couch or whatever, because sometimes we put it straight in front of them on the kitchen table and we just start trying to encourage them in with ham. Whereas if they go in backwards,
That's
easier. It's the 45er.
It's a easier thing. 45. I'd also say choose your carrier carefully. I love top-loading cat carriers, you know, where you can actually lift the thing up on the top and they can go down vertically. Then never mind 45 degrees. You're talking like 90 degrees straight down.
Yeah.
And also, when cats come to the vet these days, often we'll actually take the lid off, take the whole top half of the box off, rather than trying to pull the cat out. So having a cat carrier that you can actually disassemble that easily and take the lid off very easily, that also makes it much easier.
Good stuff. Right, well, we could talk about this, well, I could, all afternoon, how to get a cat into a cat carrier. Luckily, it doesn't happen too often. Pete the Vet, thank you as always for coming on.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.